A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The thing about genes is they feel like they've always been here. You picture a medieval peasant, a Roman farmer, a Victorian laborer, and your brain just slots them into denim. But Levi Strauss didn't file that patent until 1873. So for the thousands of years before that, what was on everyone's legs?
Wool, mostly, and canvas, and linen, and leather if you could afford it or the work demanded it. The pre-jeans trouser world is this forgotten universe of fabrics that were all, in their own ways, terrible at the job.
Daniel's been turning this over. He points out we've done a whole run of episodes on buy-it-for-life workwear and construction gear, and jeans are the ancestor of all of it. But the interesting question isn't the patent date everyone already knows. It's what people wore before, and what happened when denim started leaking out of the mineshaft and into the street.
Right. The reception. What did it feel like to be the first person in your town wearing jeans to something that wasn't digging a hole?
And what broke first on the old trousers? That rivet's actually fixed.
Let's start with the wardrobe that denim displaced. If you're a working man in, say, 1850, your trousers are almost certainly wool. Not the merino-based layer wool we think of now. Coarse, heavy, scratchy wool broadcloth or worsted. They were called slops, which is a wonderfully undignified word. S-L-O-P-S. Baggy, ill-fitting wool breeches or trousers often sold ready-made in port towns for sailors and laborers.
Slops. Sounds like what happens when you leave one out in the rain.
That's actually part of the problem. Wool absorbs water. A miner or a farmer working in wet conditions is carrying around trousers that get heavier by the hour, and wool rots. Literally rots. It mildews, it breaks down, the fibers lose all integrity. And wool has terrible abrasion resistance. You kneel on rock or wood all day, you wear through the knees in weeks.
So what were the alternatives if you didn't want to be the guy whose pants dissolved?
Canvas duck trousers. Cotton duck is a plain weave heavy cotton fabric, and it was common for sailors and some laborers by the mid-19th century. Better than wool for abrasion, lighter when dry, but it had a fundamental problem. Plain weave means the threads go over under in a simple grid. Every stress point, every seam, every pocket corner is a weak point where the weave can pull apart. You snag a pocket on a nail or a tool and the whole seam unravels.
So you're saying if I catch my pocket on a fence post, I don't just tear the pocket, I potentially unzip the entire side of the garment.
It's like a run in a stocking. The plain weave has no mechanism to stop a tear once it starts. You can watch it travel in real time. There are accounts from sailors in the 1840s describing exactly this, a pocket snag turning into a 6-inch gash before they could even set down their tools.
That's almost comically bad design for work clothing.
It wasn't design, it was just what was available. Canvas duck was originally developed for sails and tents, applications where you don't have protruding corners catching on things constantly. It got repurposed for clothing because it was cheap and heavy, not because anyone had thought through the failure modes.
And then there's linen.
Linen is strong. It's actually stronger wet than dry, which is unusual. But it wrinkles. If you look at it wrong, it wears unevenly, and it's stiff in a way that chafes. If you're doing physical labor, linen trousers are going to abrade your skin at every fold. Plus, linen was more expensive than wool for working people in a lot of places. It was a step up, not a default.
I've worn linen pants to a summer wedding and regretted it by hour 3, and I was just standing around holding a drink. I can't imagine doing a 12-hour shift in a field.
The chafing is no joke. Linen fibers are relatively inelastic, so when the fabric creases, those creases become rigid pressure points. On bare skin, that's friction. On skin that's already sweating, it's basically sandpaper. There's a reason you don't see historical paintings of happy farmers in linen trousers.
So the pre-jeans worker is choosing between trousers that rot, trousers that unravel, and trousers that sandpaper you. And leather?
Leather leggings or breeches existed, especially for loggers and some miners. But leather doesn't breathe. You're working in what's essentially a personal sauna on each leg. And leather is expensive and hard to repair. It's not a mass solution. Think about what happens when leather gets wet repeatedly and then dries. It stiffens, it cracks, it shrinks. You're constantly oiling it just to keep it wearable. A miner who's already working a 10-hour shift doesn't want to come home and condition his pants.
So the world before 1873 is this landscape of compromise trousers, and then two guys in San Francisco solve it with a metal pin.
The story is worth getting right because most people get it wrong. Levi Strauss was a dry goods merchant. He sold fabric and supplies to stores. Jacob Davis was a tailor in Reno, Nevada. One of Davis's customers kept complaining that her husband's work pants tore at the pocket corners. Davis had the idea to put copper rivets at the stress points, the pocket corners, and the base of the button fly.
Wait, so the rivet wasn't Strauss's idea at all?
No, Davis came up with it. But he didn't have the $68 to file for a patent, so he wrote to Strauss, his fabric supplier, and proposed they do it together. Strauss put up the money. They filed on May 20, 1873. Patent number 139,121. The innovation wasn't denim. Denim fabric already existed. It was the rivet.
So the entire global jeans industry is built on a tailor in Nevada being annoyed that some miner's pockets kept ripping.
And having the sense to use a copper rivet instead of just more stitching. That's the part that's genuinely brilliant. Everyone before Davis had tried to solve the durability problem with heavier fabric or double stitching. But the failure point isn't the fabric itself. It's the corner where two seams meet and the tension concentrates. A rivet distributes that load across a metal disc. It's a mechanical solution to a textile problem.
It's the same principle as a load-bearing beam in a building. You're transferring force away from the junction point.
Right. And think about what copper specifically brings to this. Copper is ductile. It deforms rather than shattering. It doesn't rust the way iron does. And it's soft enough to be set with a hand tool, which matters when your manufacturing setup is a tailor shop, not a factory. Davis could set these rivets with a hammer and a small anvil. No special machinery required.
So let's talk about the fabric itself, because denim wasn't chosen at random.
Denim is a twill weave. The threads don't go over under in a simple grid like canvas duck. They go over two, under one, or over three, under one, creating a diagonal ribbing. That diagonal structure does several things. It makes the fabric denser for the same thread count. It hides dirt because the surface isn't flat, it's textured. And it's more abrasion resistant because the long floats, the threads that skip over multiple cross threads, take the wear first before the structural threads underneath.
So denim wears from the surface down, instead of failing all at once.
It's sacrificial. The outer layer takes the damage, and the inner structure stays intact much longer. Canvas duck fails catastrophically because every thread is equally load-bearing. Denim fails gracefully.
And then there's the indigo dye. The BBC piece notes that indigo was cheap and already used for work clothes. But indigo has this property where it doesn't penetrate the cotton fiber completely. It sits on the surface. So as denim wears, the indigo rubs off and exposes the white cotton core. That's what creates the fade patterns everyone now pays extra for. In the 1870s, it just meant the pants looked broken in rather than destroyed.
It's worth pausing on that, because the aesthetic we now consider desirable, the whiskering, the honeycombs, the train tracks, was originally just a side effect of cheap dye. Nobody in 1875 was admiring his friend's sick fades. They were just pants that were wearing out in a way that looked less terrible than the alternatives.
It's like how distressed furniture became a style. Originally, a beat-up table just meant you were too poor to buy a new one.
The BBC piece notes that early jeans were called waist overalls and cost about $1.50. What's that in today's money?
Roughly $35. Affordable, but not disposable. These were an investment for a working man. You bought them expecting them to last.
Which brings us to the real question. They lasted. They solved the pocket-ripping problem. But for 60 years, nobody wore them unless they were swinging a pickaxe. What kept jeans in the workwear ghetto for so long?
Class. Pure and simple. Jeans were associated with manual labor, with dirt, with poverty. A gentleman wore wool trousers. A clerk wore wool trousers. Even a farmer, when he went to town on Saturday, changed out of his work clothes into wool trousers. Jeans marked you as someone who did physical work. And in the 19th and early 20th centuries, that wasn't a status anyone wanted to advertise.
There's a great example from the 1890s. A shopkeeper in a small California town started wearing denim overalls to work behind the counter just because they were durable and he was tired of replacing wool trousers. His customers complained, not about his service or his prices, about his pants. They felt he was lowering the tone of the establishment.
They were offended by what he was wearing while he sold them canned goods.
That's how strong the association was. It wasn't just a fashion preference. It was a violation of the social order. You could read someone's class and profession instantly by what was on their legs. Blurring that line was disruptive.
So the first adopters outside the mines were people who were still doing physical labor, just more visibly.
Cowboys and ranch hands in the 1880s and 90s. Then loggers. Then railroad workers. These were jobs that were rough on clothing, but also, crucially, jobs that had a certain cultural mythology building around them. The cowboy was becoming a romantic figure, even while actual cowboys were wearing out their jeans on the range.
And then the dude ranch happens.
This is where it gets interesting. In the 1920s and 30s, wealthy Easterners started vacationing at dude ranches. They'd go out west, play cowboy for a week, and they'd wear jeans. Then they'd come home to New York or Boston and keep wearing them as a kind of souvenir identity. It was cosplay, basically. But it was the first time jeans appeared on people with social status in non-work contexts.
So jeans got smuggled into polite society by rich people playing dress-up.
And it caused a scandal. These were people who absolutely knew better. Wearing work clothes as leisure wear was seen as a deliberate affront to social norms. It was slumming. And yet it kept spreading. By the 1930s, you had college students on the West Coast wearing jeans to class. Not because they were laborers, but because they wanted to signal something.
What were they signaling?
That's the question, isn't it? At first, it was probably just comfort and durability. Jeans are more comfortable than wool trousers once they're broken in. But very quickly, it became about rejecting the formality of their parents' generation. The same kids who'd been sent to college in slacks and ties were choosing denim specifically because it annoyed the administration.
So, practically from the jump, jeans had this double identity. They were simultaneously the most practical garment ever invented, and a symbol of rebellion. That's a weird combination. Usually practical things are boring.
And that tension is exactly what makes the history so strange. The same pair of pants could mean, I'm a serious working man who needs functional clothing, and I'm rejecting everything my parents stand for. Those two meanings don't naturally go together, but they got fused onto the same object.
And the administration fought back.
Hard. High schools across America banned jeans outright in the 1940s and 50s. Students were sent home to change. The stated reasons were decorum and discipline, but the subtext was panic about juvenile delinquency. Jeans had become associated with the wrong kind of teenager.
There's a specific case I read about. A school district in California in 1947 suspended a student named, I think, Barbara something, for wearing jeans to class. Her parents sued, and the court upheld the suspension, ruling that the school had the right to maintain standards of dress.
And the judge's opinion basically said that jeans were inappropriate for an academic setting because they were associated with recreation and manual labor, neither of which belonged in a classroom. The logic was circular. Jeans are inappropriate because we've decided they're inappropriate.
And then Hollywood poured gasoline on the fire.
Marlon Brando in The Wild One, 1953. James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause, 1955. Both of them in jeans. Both playing the exact kind of brooding, anti-authority young man that school dress codes were designed to suppress. The timing is almost too perfect. The schools ban jeans to prevent delinquency, and Hollywood immediately turns the jeans-wearing delinquent into the most glamorous figure in America.
There's a detail in the research about Montgomery Clift.
Yes. The 1951 film A Place in the Sun. Clift plays a working-class young man who gets involved with a wealthy woman. The director wanted him in jeans for certain scenes to establish the class contrast visually. But the studio had to get special permission because jeans were considered too casual for cinema. In 1951, a man wearing trousers he owned was too casual to be shown in a movie theater.
That's the part that's hard to reconstruct. Not the fact of the ban, but the feeling. What it was like to be the one kid in your school who wore jeans and got sent home. Or the one woman in your office who wore them and got called into HR.
The gender dimension is its own whole story. Women wearing trousers at all was controversial well into the 20th century. During World War II, Rosie the Riveter made women in work pants a patriotic image. But after the war, there was enormous cultural pressure for women to return to skirts and dresses. A woman in jeans in the 1950s was making a statement whether she meant to or not. It was associated with loose morals, with rejecting domesticity, with a kind of masculine rebellion that was considered deeply unfeminine.
So you've got multiple overlapping anxieties. Class anxiety, generational anxiety, gender anxiety, all of them projected onto a pair of cotton trousers with copper rivets.
And that's why the adoption art took a century, from 1873 to roughly 1973. 100 years to go from Mein Schaft to universal garment. That's not a fashion trend. That's a cultural negotiation.
It's like the garment had to wait for everyone who remembered the original stigma to die off, or at least lose cultural power.
That's exactly what happened. Each generation that grew up with jeans as forbidden fruit eventually became the generation in charge, and by then, jeans were just what they'd always worn. The stigma couldn't reproduce itself fast enough.
The BBC piece says by 1980, 90% of Americans owned at least one pair of jeans.
Which means the final normalization happened in the 1960s and 70s. The counterculture adopted jeans as anti-fashion. Hippies wore them. Protesters wore them. And then something paradoxical happened. When the anti-fashion people all wear the same thing, it becomes fashion. By the mid-70s, jeans were just what people wore. The rebellion had won so completely that it stopped being a rebellion.
There's a pattern there. The contamination model of fashion adoption. Something starts at the bottom of the status ladder, gets picked up by a higher status group as a kind of transgression, and then the transgression becomes so widespread that it's no longer transgressive.
And the original stigma evaporates. Nobody in 2026 thinks jeans are low class. The idea is almost incomprehensible. You can wear jeans to a nice restaurant now. You can wear them to a wedding if it's the right kind of wedding. The garment that got teenagers sent home from school is now acceptable everywhere short of a state dinner.
I wore jeans to a funeral once. It was a casual funeral, specified by the deceased. But still, jeans at a funeral.
And did anyone object?
Not a single person. My grandmother would have been horrified, but she wasn't there.
That's the normalization in a nutshell. The objection becomes unthinkable, and then it becomes literally impossible to explain to someone younger why anyone ever cared.
So what does this history tell us about buying jeans today? Because Daniel's original question ties back to the buy it for life conversation.
The biggest lesson is that durability isn't about fabric weight. It's about construction details. The pre-jeans trousers failed at specific points, pocket corners, fly bases, knee stress zones. Davis solved that with rivets. Modern quality jeans use rivets, bar tacks, flat felled seams, double stitching. When you're buying jeans that are supposed to last, you look at the stress points, not the denim weight.
A 12-ounce denim with reinforced stress points will outlast an 18-ounce denim with single stitching at the pockets.
Every time. And yet most people shopping for durable jeans just look at the ounce weight. It's like buying a car based on how thick the door sounds when you close it.
How do you actually check the stress points in a store? You can't exactly start yanking on seams.
You can, actually. Turn the jeans inside out. Look at the pocket corners. Is there a rivet? Is there a bar tack, which is that dense zigzag stitch that reinforces a single point? Look at the crotch seam. Is it a flat felled seam where the fabric is folded over and double stitched? Or is it just serged, which is that overlock stitch that looks like a series of loops? Serge seams are faster and cheaper to produce, but they're weaker. Flat felled seams distribute tension across more fabric and more stitching.
So you're looking for metal, dense stitching at corners, and folded over seams at major junctions.
And if you don't see those things, it doesn't matter how heavy the denim is. It's going to fail at the weak point.
The other lesson is about fit, which you've mentioned before. A jean that's too tight in the thigh is going to blow out the crotch seam, regardless of how well it's constructed. The fabric needs room to move without pulling at the seams.
Right? And that's a pre-jeans problem, too. Those wool slops were baggy for a reason. They weren't tailored, they didn't look good, but they allowed freedom of movement. Modern jeans have to balance fit and durability, and most fashion jeans are way too far on the fit side.
There's a fun fact here that I stumbled across. The original Levi's had a crotch rivet, right at the base of the fly. They removed it in 1941.
The story I've heard is that the company president, Walter Haas, went on a camping trip and crouched too close to a fire. The crotch rivet conducted heat directly to a very sensitive area, and he decided then and there that the rivet had to go.
That's either the best or worst product testing story I've ever heard.
It's probably apocryphal, but it does illustrate something real. The rivet solved a structural problem, but created a comfort problem in that specific location. The bar tack replaced it, which is a stitched reinforcement that doesn't conduct heat. It's a good reminder that even the best design solutions have trade-offs.
Which connects to something I've been thinking about. The whole workwear industry is drifting away from overbuild. Stretched denim, lighter weights, elastane blends. They're more comfortable, but they're not more durable. We're kind of circling back to the pre-rivet era in terms of construction philosophy, except now the failure point is the fabric itself degrading.
Stretch fibers fatigue. Elastane breaks down after a certain number of wash cycles and stretch cycles. 100% cotton denim with rivets will outlast any stretch blend, but it won't be as comfortable on day one. So the consumer has to choose break-in period versus lifespan.
And most people choose comfort.
Which is a perfectly rational choice if you're not actually mining. The original jeans were solving a problem most modern wearers don't have. My pockets aren't tearing out from the weight of ore samples. I'm not kneeling on rock for 10 hours a day. So the durability equation is different.
But that's exactly why understanding the history matters. When you know what problem the rivet was solving, you can ask whether you need that solution. If you're a construction worker, you absolutely do. If you're sitting at a desk, maybe you don't. But at least you're making an informed choice instead of just buying whatever the marketing tells you is authentic workwear.
The other thing the history teaches is that every garment we think of as timeless was once radical. Jeans were scandalous within living memory. My grandparents' generation would have remembered when jeans weren't okay. And now we're seeing the same cycle with other workwear items, carpenter pants, cargo trousers, chore coats. All of them started as functional garments for specific trades, got adopted by fashion, and are now in that weird middle phase where they're simultaneously trendy and practical.
The cargo pants discourse is basically the jeans discourse from 1955, just compressed into TikTok.
And the same people who are horrified by cargo pants now would have been horrified by jeans then. The arguments are identical, they're sloppy, they're inappropriate, they signal the wrong things. Give it 20 years and cargo pants will be wedding attire.
If sloths had invented cargo pants, they'd have put the pockets on the inside for safekeeping. Much more secure.
That's just a pouch. You're describing a pouch.
A highly advanced internal storage system that anteaters could never access.
I don't know how we got from Jacob Davis's patent to anteater-proof trousers, but I'm impressed by the efficiency.
Let's steelman the counter-argument. Someone listening to this could say, look, jeans won. The market decided. All this history about wool slops and social stigma is interesting but irrelevant to actually buying pants today. What's the point?
The point is that the market didn't decide all at once. It took 100 years of cultural argument, and during that argument, the people who wore jeans outside work contexts were making a choice that had real social costs. Understanding the history makes you a smarter consumer because you can see when the same pattern is playing out again with a different garment. You're not just buying pants. You're participating in a process that's been running since the 1870s.
And the process isn't neutral. When you choose to wear something that's coded as workwear in a non-work context, you're making a claim about yourself. You're saying something about your relationship to labor, to class, to formality. Most people don't think about it consciously, but the history is still operating under the surface.
The rivet is still doing its job, culturally speaking. It's holding together a whole set of meanings that most wearers never examine.
So here's the open question. What's the jeans of 2026? What garment today is going through the same arc, where it's currently scandalous or low status or niche, and in 50 years it'll be universal?
I think the answer might be something we're not even noticing yet. Jeans in 1880 were just work pants. Nobody would have predicted they'd become the default legwear of the entire planet. The next universal garment is probably something that's currently too specific, too functional, too associated with a particular kind of work, and we're all ignoring it because it doesn't look like fashion.
Or it's something that hasn't been invented yet. The next Jacob Davis is out there right now, looking at a failure point on some garment we all wear, about to put a rivet through it and change everything.
And if history is any guide, he'll need $68 from a fabric supplier to make it happen.
We should thank Hilbert Flemingtop for producing, as always. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.